you know, kind of feel a certain sympathy for her. And yeah, they're all really frustrating characters in a really good way, because you're thinking, why did you do that? What's the matter with you? And why don't you just talk? And why don't you tell the truth instead of pretending? And yeah, it was such a good book. I don't know anything really about the Irish experience and the Irish immigrant experience and all those things. Obviously they are an Irish family. Greta and Robert have moved to London from Ireland. I think they'd met in London, to be fair, but they're both, you know, kind of first generation immigrants, whereas their children obviously born and bred in London. But they're still very much, you know, they used to go back to Ireland every summer as children, and they grew up in a kind of Irish London community. And there's also, there's elements of that, because of course this is the 70s, you know, and I grew up in the 80s and early 90s, so I haven't forgotten bombs going off reasonably often on the news, you know? It's not something that ever touched me directly, because I live in the southwest and we, you know, we're not as affected as other parts of the country. But I remember these things happening all too frequently on the news. And I mean, there's just little references to the Troubles. There's Greta talks about how she used to go to the shop, and then one day, even though she'd been shopping there for 20 years, they turned her away and they didn't want her sort shopping there anymore. And it was, you know, because of a bomb going off. And, you know, so there's also that tension. There's the fact that Greta's, you know, got very strong principles with regards to her religion, and, you know, she's shocked and horrified at the suggestion that Aoife, for example, might be walking out with a man and not, you know, not be considering marriage. And she's even more horrified when it occurs to her that he might not be Catholic. So there's a lot of kind of interesting tensions and things there that I don't have much experience of, but they come across. Like, yeah, I'm just rambling, but, and it's got a mystery at its heart. It's got several, actually, but the main one, obviously, is this father who's just walked away. Where is he gone? Will they be able to find him? But there's also, as I say, there's a mystery about Monica. Why did she fall out with Aoife? You know, why is she so unhappy and so angry? There's a mystery about Michael Francis and his marriage and what went wrong and whether he can sort it out. And there's a big secret that Aoife is carrying, which isn't really a mystery right from the start. The very early pages, you find out Aoife's secret. But she keeps it. She doesn't tell anybody. Nobody knows. And so for most, so that's why I'm not telling you, because for most of the book, it is just her secret, and only you and her know. And, you know, that's one of the most frustrating things, actually, because I think Aoife was probably my favourite character anyway, because, you know, she's this crazy, intelligent, wild character who's kind of gone off and is living this bohemian lifestyle, and, you know, she's a cool kid, but she's carrying this huge secret, and it affects every aspect of her life. And just want to say to her, come on, girl, sort it out, just tell someone. so
why do you think she doesn't?
I can't say without really revealing what the secret is. I completely understand why she keeps it a secret. I do completely understand why. But it's that thing, I think, as well, where she doesn't want to tell the world her secret, but you kind of wonder why she doesn't tell her loved ones. But the fact is that once it's gone on for so long without her loved ones knowing, how could she tell them? Because
So we will know when we get to there. It's one of these things. You feel that it will never make sense, but eventually it does.
Yeah, it's... I mean, that particular... Her particular secret you learn very early on in the book. But as I say, I don't want to reveal it, even though I know it is told early. Because I feel like, yeah, you should discover it for yourself, because it's just a wonderful book. Every time I read a book by Maggie O'Farrell, I think, oh no, this one's my favourite, definitely. And then I read another one and I'm like, nope, this one's even better. But Yeah, these characters really get under your skin. I think that's the thing. And a part of me is really glad that Maggie O'Farrell doesn't seem to be someone who writes sequels, but the rest of me really wants her to write sequels because I want to know, you know, I'd love to go back to the Reardons in 5 years' time and, you know, kind of find out in the early 80s what they're up to. And yeah.
Yes, an interesting possibility.
Yeah.
So have you read her other novels as well?
Yeah, I've read a few. I'm going to have to struggle to remember what they're all called. But The Vanishing Act of Esme Lennox, The Distance Between Us, The Hand That First Held Mine, and After You'd Gone. I've read all of those. I haven't read My Mother's Lover. I think that's the only one I haven't.
Did you find a common theme, or were they very different from each other?
They're all very different. They're all very character-led. They're all very much characters and secrets and kind of atmosphere. But beyond that, they're all quite different. I mean, The Vanishing Act of Esme Lennox is about a young woman who inherits an old woman, in a way. She's contacted one day about this woman, Esme Lennox, who's being released from a mental asylum after 60 years, and you're her next of kin.
Where's that happening?
Where?
Yeah.
London or Edinburgh? I think it might be Edinburgh.
Yes, that would make sense.
Yeah.
So what sort of year is that happening?
Well, it's got a kind of double timeline, so it's contemporary when this patient is being released from this asylum, but it also has flashbacks to the young Esme Lennox in the sort of 20s or 30s when she was this, you know, wild, unruly child and then wild, unruly teenager, and you kind of find out what happened to her and what led to her being put away. So again, there's this kind of mystery at its heart of what happened. And then in the woman, you know, the contemporary woman who's completely, you know, unsettled by this strange, in inverted commas, mad woman that she's suddenly, you know, being inflicted with.
So the disappearance is the character who's been in hospital for 60
yes.
years.
Yes, yeah.
And the novel that you've just read is also about somebody who disappears.
It is, yeah.
I notice a theme growing here.
Yeah.
And while you were talking, I realised it's an incredible coincidence that the play I was talking about at the beginning of the programme,
yeah.
August Osage County, which is set in Oklahoma, is about a man called Beverly Weston, who disappears.
Ah.
And then the family all come together. So if you're liking the sound of this story, next Wednesday at the Northcott, August Osage County is opening. But to come back to the book that you're reading here, how did you first come to hear about Maggie O'Farrell?
Well, I think working in Waterstones, she was just an author. I can remember when The Vanishing Act of Esme Lennox came out in hardback. It had a cover that I didn't entirely like, but it did kind of interest me. So I was aware of it, and I think at some point there was a damaged copy of that book in paperback, which I picked up and read. And having read that, I loved it. I was like, oh, wow, this is such a good book. So then I looked out for another one. I bought The Hand That First Held Mine and read it. Somebody gave me a copy of The Distance Between Us. When I saw there was a new one, I was just like, yes, excellent. New Maggie O'Farrell, fabulous. As I say, I think there's just one left that I haven't read, which I will get to at some point because I've just enjoyed every book I've read by her.
This novel came out towards the end of last year, is that right?
Yeah, it would have been out in hardback first. So it probably came out in 2012. Oh, no, first published 2013. So I would guess it must have been out in hardback fairly early in the year because the paperback came out in the autumn. Such a good book.
So a great book. I'm glad you brought that one in. That's been a great start to the programme. It's nearly time for us to talk to our special guest
yes,
today.
Yes, I think what we'll probably do, I've got... I can't remember where Roykasoppa from. I'd like to think they're from Iceland. they're definitely from somewhere cold and northern. It might be somewhere else in Scandinavia rather than Iceland. But I've got a track from them, and then we'll be going into our interview with Julie.
Julie Sampson will be with us, I hope, at 11:15, immediately after this track. So while the music is playing, we shall feverishly make contact with Julie up in Taunton. Just tell us again, what are we about to do?
It's a track called A Higher Place, and it's by Royksopp.
Lovely.
So that was A Higher Place by Royksopp, which may or may not be Icelandic, but was certainly quite atmospheric and I thought nicely in keeping with some Maggie O'Farrell. And we should now have our guest with us on the radio line, Julie Sampson from Taunton.
Yes, good morning.
Hello there, it's lovely to speak to you.
Lovely to speak to you too. I wish I was in Devon, because it's my home county, so I always got very, very fond memories of Devon. And my writing is basically, on the whole, based on the county, on my home roots.
Luke was saying your new poetry book actually has Hound Tour on the cover.
Oh, well, I, to be quite honest with you, at my book launch on Saturday in Taunton, I was told afterwards by my husband that there was a lot of discussion as to where the cover was on Dartmoor. And I didn't actually know, because my publisher acquired the picture, the photo, and it's a lovely photo, but I haven't actually found out, so I now know it's Hound Tour. But it's a nice photo for those who haven't seen it, with the moon in the background, which I thought was quite unusual and quite appropriate for the book, because the book is, it has a long sequence at the end, which is on concerning my research into Devon's lost woman writers, because I'm trying to complete a manuscript at this moment of non-fiction about the subject. So the poetry is at the end of the book, but the book itself has other poems as well, but there's quite a long sequence at the end which is to do with women writers from Devon.
I see. So I'm trying to think of any women writers from Devon, and I'm sure there are lots.
Well, yes, there are many, many women writers. But what happened was, I finished my PhD quite a few years ago at Exeter University, and my subject was the American writer Hilda Doolittle, who's always known by her initials HD, because people usually say, who is HD? Well, she was Hilda Doolittle. She was an American writer, and she spent much of her life in England and in Europe. And she actually she lived in Cornwall for quite a few months of her life, and she even spent some time in Devon, in North Devon, at the village of Martinhoe in North Devon in 1916 during the First World War. And I think after I finished my PhD, I got a little bit interested in her sort of spending time up there, and I did some research and I located where she stayed and found out more about her. And then I thought to myself, might as well have a look and see if I can find out about if there were other woman writers who stayed and lived and wrote in Devon. And to be quite honest with you, at the time I thought it would be a little bit of light relief. There wouldn't be that many. I knew a few. Pardon?
I was just chuckling.
I knew a few names. I knew about Anna Braith and Tavistock, and I probably knew, obviously, I knew about Agatha Christie and I knew about Sylvia Plath. But I went away and I went to the library and I went to Devon and Exeter Institution, and went to the library there and started to look, and gradually a few names popped up here, there and everywhere, and I found a few names of poems and writers. There was the 16th century Anne Dowrich, who was born Anne Edgecombe, who was actually born at either Mount Edgecombe or at Coathill, which her father, Sir Richard Edgecombe, was the builder of Mount Edgecombe in the 16th century. And I think this writer, Anne Dowrich, I think she was born there. And then she married Hugh Dowrich of Dowrich House, which is actually near Sanford, near Crediton. And she wrote a very, very, very long epic poem called The French History, which is actually in French, the title is French Histoire, and it's such a long and sort of almost violent poem at times. And when I first started to read it, I was very taken aback by the nature of its aggressiveness, really, because it's quite a gory, a rich poem with all sorts of detail about the Huguenots in France. There's a St. Bartholomew's Day massacre. And anyway, this is going off on a sidetrack, but I sort of began to look at this Anne Dowrich, and I gradually, over a few years, began to get all sorts of information on her. And later on, I had a paper published on her in the Devonshire's Association Transactions a couple of years ago. She's very interesting. And I thought to myself, well, If there was Anne Dowrich, there must have been others. So, of course, gradually, names started to pop out of the woodwork. And I, somebody said to me the other day, how many names have you got? And I said, well, I'm sure I've got more than 50. Obviously, not all these people, not all these women were good or what you would call skilled writers. But the thing is, it's like a neglected archive, which we don't seem to know about, of letters, journals, fiction, non-fiction, every kind of genre you could imagine is covered. And we've got this one or two women writers, particularly the late 19th century, whose names really, really should be back. Their books should be in the shops, and they're not. One of them is Mary Patricia Wilcox. She was what you might call an early feminist writer, and she wrote many novels, lots of them based on the Devonshire landscape, particularly Dartmoor. And I found about her because Bob Mann, I don't know if you've heard of Bob Mann, who lives in in Totnes. He's a journalist. I hope you'll be happy with me mentioning his name. I think he will. But it was because of him that I found out about Mary Patricia Wilcox, because he'd already found out about her. This is going back, say, 15 to 20 years, and had already written some articles about her. And I met him, and he told me about her. And so I started to look into her. And she, as I said, she's one of the most neglected of the whole lot, I think.
Mm. It'll be interesting to see whether she kind of comes back into print, because I know a lot of authors, I mean, people like Elizabeth Taylor and Barbara Pym, and, I mean, Stella Gibbons is a particular case, actually, where Cold Comfort Farm has always been in print, but she wrote masses, and most of it was out of print for a really long time. But the last few years, there's been a real resurgence of kind of, you know, books that have been published maybe by women, especially in the 20th century, that have been reissued by people like Persephone Classics. And
absolutely, yes, you're absolutely right about that. Well, this is really what I'm hoping. I mean, and as you say, it's already happening in many respects. But the thing is, I think that down here in the Southwest, one tends to think, as you've already said, who are these women? That they didn't exist. But the thing is, they did exist. And I think it's really important that their names shouldn't be obliterated from the canon, really, from the literary archive of our county, because not just because their names should be reinstated, but also because the things that they wrote tell us have got such a wealth of information about our county, our counties, our area, our district.
So is it just writers who are kind of born and lived in Devon, or is it also people who visited?
Well, I started off with looking at women writers who were born and lived in the county, and my interest is in the whole of the Southwest, obviously, but I'm trying to complete a book on Devon writers, because otherwise it gets too complicated.
You've got to draw a line somewhere.
Yes, absolutely. So but then I sort of got a bit, as I said, with HD, Hilda Doolittle, she didn't live permanently down here, but the thing is, when she was living at Martinhoe, she was there for 3 or 4 months. When she was there, she wrote some of her most kind of powerful poems. So I think it's quite important, really, to be aware that sometimes people, writers, can say, be staying in an area, and they can actually write about somewhere else, and perhaps their writing wouldn't have turned out so well if they'd been living in the proper area, if you know what I mean.
No, it's very true. And I think, I mean, you know, although I'm Devon born and bred and I've never lived anywhere else, I feel quite a strong attachment to, say, places that I went on holiday as a child. So even though I've no perspective on living, say, in the Lake District, but I feel like I know it because of those holidays.
Yes, exactly.
Although I recognise that I don't know the realities of living there at all.
Yes.
But, yeah, I think places can... You can form a real attachment and knowledge of a place.
Well, sometimes it can work the other way. Yeah. I was saying at the book launch the other day, Jean Rhys, and obviously you've heard of Jean Rhys, and you've heard of White Sargasso Sea, of course.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you know that she did actually live down in Devon. I said down in Devon because I'm up in Taunton. But she did live in Bude for a while, but what I know more about is the time that she lived in Cheriton Pitspain, which is just up north from Crediton. And actually she was living there, although at the time I wasn't aware, when I was in my final couple of years at school in Crediton doing A-levels. And I do remember the teachers saying, our English teachers saying to us, oh, we would like to get Jean Rhys to come and talk to you, but she won't because she's such a recluse. And I've got that in my mind even now.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, well, I wonder who, you know, because at the time I didn't really know anything about her. But latterly, I discovered that she wrote much, she wrote and worked on Wide Sargasso Sea while she was living in that cottage, which she hated. She absolutely hated it, because she wrote about how it was damp and she hated the views and everything. But she managed to encapsulate her homeland, the tropical kind of areas of her homeland, the tropical seas and everything, the tropical landscape, in the book, in her, from her imagination, although she was living in this horrible place that she absolutely hated.
That cold cottage. Yeah. Quite a contrast. It is interesting, actually, because, like, as we've been talking, I've been thinking about who I know, and because I've got a certain knowledge of children's literature, so I immediately think of Mary Norton.
Right.
Because she, I think, lived near Heartland.
Yes, I have come across her, but yeah, as you can appreciate, I haven't had a chance to go into depth with everybody.
Of course,
it's just not possible.
No.
And what I've actually have done is I'm trying to complete a book, I think I said, at the moment. Mm. And the first time I wrote it, I thought I would try and be clever and get everybody into it, but somehow it just didn't seem to end up in the right kind of mode, in the right kind of style. So after sort of showing it to one or two people, I'm now in the third draft, and I'm doing it in a completely different way.
So narrowing it
and
down.
And I'm not trying to carry to kind of discuss and incorporate everybody.
No,
but
it wouldn't
I have
be possible.
Heard of Mary Norton.
Yeah, and the other one that I think of, and I don't, as far as I know, she never did live in Devon, but Susan Coolidge, who wrote What Katie Did.
Yes.
There was actually 5 books that followed Katie and her family, and in the, I think it's the 5th book, there's a whole sequence in sort of Biddeford and Clovelly.
Right, I think I have come across that somewhere along the line, but now you've said that, you've jogged my memory, and I'll go and have a look at that when I get a chance.
It was really surreal for me reading it, because I absolutely loved the books as a children, and I managed to track down all the first 4 of them. So
yes,
the 3 that the What Katie Did, What Katie Did at School, and What Katie Did Next are
yes,
all in print and have remained in print.
Yes.
But the final 2, which are called Clover and In the High Valley,
right,
were no longer in print. And so I literally, from about the age of 12, I was trying to track these books down, and I managed to track down Clover when
yes,
I was about 13 or 14, but it wasn't until I was 18 that I found a copy of In the High Valley.
Right.
And read it. And the opening sequences are all about this brother and sister who are living, I can't remember, they're living in Clovelly, and they walk to Abbotsham, and they go to Biddeford, and,
yes,
and they
yes,
stop by the Hoops Inn on the way past. And
yes. So she must have been very familiar with the area.
Yeah,
then, wasn't she?
That's it.
It does ring a bell, actually, Jill,
yeah,
but I can't, without going off and looking at all my notes and everything, but I don't know that I know as much as you said, but I've certainly come across her somehow or other in connection with the county.
Yeah. It was so surreal for me reading it, because of course that's the part of the world that I'm from myself. I'm from North Devon, and
oh,
so
yeah,
I knew these places, and then I knew these characters who were in this book that was set in, I mean, you know, Midwest.
Yes.
And yeah, it was very, very strange, them kind of invading my part of the world. I was like, oh.
Yes, I do understand.
And I've always wondered, you know, how Susan Coolidge, who was an American author, and as far as I know, all her other books, apart from the Europe trip, where Katie does Europe, you know, they are very much that kind of American domestic children's novel kind of thing. So quite how this came about, it was very strange. And I mean, what happens is that one or two of these siblings from England travel to the States and then fall in love with some of the Carr family, and ultimately,
yes,
you know, all live happily ever after in America. But
yes,
yeah, it was very,
it's strange how one writer can pop up, so you kind
yeah,
of associate a writer with one particular area or one particular country or one particular county, and then suddenly in their books you suddenly notice that there's another landscape totally
yeah,
kind of brought into it. So it does kind of jolt you in a sense, mm, doesn't it, and make you sort of think, well, what's going on here? And but one of my interests in the writers of that kind of area is the Kingsley Charles Kingsley family, which you probably heard of them, because but he, there was a kind of a nucleus of women around him. There was his sister Charlotte Chanter, who married the vicar of Ilfracombe, and she wrote a book called Ferny Combs, which is all about, it sounds a bit way out, but it was actually about her explorations of, I think, the whole of the county. I think they covered Dartmoor and Exeter in the 19th century, and they were exploring rare ferns and kind of cataloguing them. But in the end, she wrote this book about the wanderings and the ferns that she'd discovered. It's rather a good book. And she also wrote fiction. She wrote a book called Over the Cliffs. So she's very worth looking into.
Yeah.
There's Lucas Mallet, who I think was her sister-in-law, who was another 19th century novelist. Mm. And there was Gratiana Chanter, who was her daughter. So there's a whole little group.
Yeah.
Yes, we're missing one person out here. Sorry about this.
Hello.
I haven't introduced myself yet. I'm Luke.
Nice to talk to you.
And no, I'm very interested in everything you're saying, but of course we have to remember that we're missing one person out. It's Julie Sampson, and you've just had a new book published.
Yes, I have indeed.
Yes, don't forget yourself in your writers in Devon.
Well, it's my book. The book itself, the book as it stands, this poetry book, it isn't all about writers from Devon. I want to be clear about that, because I wouldn't want people buying it on the misapprehension that it's all. But there's a long sequence at the end, which is to do with my research. And what it is really is, it's, I started off by thinking that I would write a sequence of sonnets. And I laugh because basically I'm not completely conventional in my writing, so I'm a little bit experimental. So inevitably, as the sequence developed, the sonnets sort of became looser and looser. So they're not really sonnets, but I've got a selection of some of the poems based on individual writers in the collection. I've got one, for example. I've got a long one on Mary Patricia Wilcox, who I mentioned earlier on. I've got one about... I've got a long one with three poems, which is based on Freya Stark, whose childhood was spent on Dartmoor. Her father built a house just near to Chagford in 1910, and apparently he used to take his family there, and they used to ramble on the moor. Sometimes I think maybe she acquired her love of travelling through her childhood experiences on the moor. That poem is in there. Then I've got another poem about Beatrice Chase, who you may or may not have heard of. Beatrice Chase lived in Widdicombe in the Moor, and she was quite notorious in her time, so I understand. Even my parents remember her being there. She used to write from her Dartmoor window, and apparently when they went through Widdicombe back in the days with the early motor car, inevitably she'd be there sitting in the window looking out and writing. And her most famous book is called Heart of the Moor, and I'm sure some of the listeners will have heard of it or possibly even read it. It's a rather strange book, and she's rather a sort of eccentric person, but still worth remembering, you know.
Yes, you're going to share some of this with us on Thursday, aren't you, Julie?
Yes, I'm coming to Exeter on Thursday evening to the Phoenix, to the Arts Centre, and sharing the guest spot with the poet Alwyn Marridge. So that would be very interesting. So I should be hopefully reading some of the poems from that sequence at the reading. Yes,
that'll be in the black box here in the Phoenix, which is actually where we're broadcasting from.
Oh,
right,
is it? Well,
now.
I wasn't aware of that, because obviously being up in Taunton, I'm not quite so familiar with local Exeter stations as I should be.
Yes, well, it would be nice to hear some of your work. And while you were talking about your study of other authors, I was having a look at your website, which is coming on quite nicely. There's a featured writer who is none other than Mary Patricia Wilcox.
Yes, Mary Patricia Wilcox. Yes, I'm glad you've mentioned that, actually, because that website is actually under reconstruction at the moment. I did that website probably 6-7 years ago, and at the time, of course, my research was slightly different from... I've done a lot more since then, so I'm trying to update it, really. And I would like just to say that I've been so busy just recently trying to sort of get the book finalised and published, and my next one I'm trying to complete. But I do have a blog which is more current than that website. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Oh, no. What's it called?
Well, it's got a slightly strange title, but it's called Scraplog, A Writer from the Southwest. And if you have a look, I haven't done it recently because, as I said, I've been rather busy. But what I do on there is I've been trying to sort of build up a collection of different pieces and short pieces and slightly longer pieces on different aspects of the research as I've come across it, really. Different things that have intrigued me, really. For example, I did one long piece on Mary Coleridge, her connection with Devon. She actually used to come and stay at Halston House, and when she was a child, apparently. So all sorts of little quirky things, really, you might find on there if you're interested in this subject.
Yes, and you're updating that as time goes on.
Well, the blog is an occasional blog. I haven't done it so much, as I said, in the last few months because I just haven't had the chance. So the Southwest Woman Writers is the main website. That one I'm upgrading at the moment. And the scrap blog, A Writer from the Southwest, is my occasional blog. So they both kind of interact with each other, I suppose.
Yes. I was just looking then to see if there was a link from the website to the
blog.
Yeah,
there is a link. There was a link, and I'm just having a look myself. Yes, if you look at the opening page where it actually says this website is currently under reconstruction, and it does say most information is still here, but some of the links might be missing. If you scroll right down to the bottom, Scraplog, A Writer from the Southwest, comes up as a link in white. Can you find it?
Now, I'm looking at the information page at the moment.
No, if you go to the home page.
Oh, here we are. Never come to Devon until you have come to die.
if you scroll right down.
Yes, here it is.
The Scraplog, and also there's a photo gallery there.
Yes, that's right. I haven't been able to load it this morning, but there are a couple of very beautiful photographs just on the website itself, little thumbnails. And I can see you've got your Twitter.
Yes, I've got a
link
Twitter account as well.
So if people want to communicate with you, they can do that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, of course. So those are ongoing. The links are there. They're ongoing links.
Well, this is lovely. And, of course, if people want to actually see you and hear you, find out more about you, this is on Thursday. Are you going to give a talk about yourself as well?
On Thursday?
On Thursday, yes.
Well, not really. It's a reading. It's more of a reading, so I understand. So, I mean, I will be obviously providing a bit of a background to some of the poems and some of the work I read, but I'm not envisioning having a discussion or talk. But on the other hand, if anyone has any questions, I'm quite happy to try and answer them if I can.
Oh, well, I'll add in details about that later in the programme this morning.
Thank you very much.
And in fact, you're already on the Classical Journey website, which is which is the programme that we're on at the moment.
Can I ask you a question? Can I actually listen to? Is it phonic?
Oh, I'm very glad you did ask that question. Yes,
I can find it on the internet.
Yes,
can
if you write phonic.fm,
right,
you get to a website.
Okay,
which tells you about the station and also has a little icon that says listen.
Okay.
That's a lovely cue, actually, because I say that about 10 times during every programme, that's how people can listen in. If it doesn't work, you can go to a website called TuneIn.
Okay.
Which gives you a list of all the stations worldwide. And if you can find Phonic FM on there, then you can tune in that way as well.
I'll certainly have a go now I've been introduced to you.
Yeah. I hope that you will listen in. And I am hoping that you would join me on the Classical Journey next week, if you have time.
Well, I'd love to. Thank you very much for asking me. And thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk to everyone today. Because, as I'm trying to say, I think it's quite important for people who are interested in literature that we don't forget some of the writers whose names have been forgotten and kind of almost obliterated in some cases, with the obvious exceptions of Agatha Christie.
It's not that Agatha Christie doesn't deserve to be remembered, but there's so many other gems that people may not realise are out there. So
absolutely.
It's a really nice way of kind of learning a little bit more about your area. And I think literature is such a fantastic way to learn about the history of the area. And
oh, you're so right. You're so right. One of the things I'm trying to do in the book that I'm trying to finish now is I'm trying to weave in a little bit of personal ancestry, because, like, I think you said that you come from Devon, didn't you?
Yes.
Well, as you obviously realise, my roots are in Devon, and I'm very interested as I get older in family history and ancestry and everything. And I've discovered that most of my family branches do come from Devon.
Oh.
And so sometimes, just occasionally, you're doing a bit of research in some archive or on the internet or something, and you suddenly find a name and you think, well, maybe this name might just connect with my family. So sometimes you find something that actually can tell you something that's really personal historical information, which is wonderful.
Yeah, that's quite creepy, but in a good way.
Oh, yes, it can be quite creepy, I guess. Yes, it could be, yes.
So thank you very much for joining us, and I hope that your event at the Phoenix on Thursday goes very well.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you very much, both of you, for giving me the opportunity on air.
If listeners do have any questions for you, I'm sure they could email studio@phonic.fm, and then Luke could...
A little late in the programme now, but if you email Luke
phonic.fm. Yeah, you could talk about them next week, you say.
So. Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
I'll tell people how to do that in a minute. Thank you so much for joining us, Julie.
Well, thank you very much, both of you. You can find me on Twitter from that website. That's probably the quickest way, actually.
Absolutely. I'll repeat that in a moment. Thank you very much for joining us.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you.
Many thanks.
Yes, goodbye, Julie.
Bye-bye for now. Bye-bye.
Cheerio.
And what music have we got now, June?
We've got a little bit of Lemon Jelly coming up. This is Spacewalk.
Lovely.
The hatch is coming open. Okay. It's open.
Verified.
I'm moving outside. Okay, I'm letting go. Starting to drift away. It really is dark out here. How am I doing?
You're doing fine.
I'm beginning to see a point of light on the horizon.
So that was Lemon Jelly with Spacewalk. We've just been speaking with Julie Sampson, who spoke a little bit about her new poetry book and also about her Writers in Devon project. It was very interesting. And if you do want to hear more about her, come along on Thursday to her event at the Phoenix. You were going to say something
about the spacewalk.
Yes.
Well, the spacewalk was very interesting. The way it started was very, very similar to a work by a librarian here at Exeter Library called Simon Belshaw, called Between the Moon and the Earth, which we've heard on the Classical Journey many times. And it's actually performed by Exeter Contemporary Sounds. And Exeter Contemporary Sounds have played in Exeter quite a few times, including at the non-classical sessions at the Bike Shed. And regular listeners to Classical Journey know what I mean by non-classical. This is new compositions, new artists, all sorts of fun. And we've always hoped that there might be more non-classical outlets in Devon, and now there is a new outlet at Totnes. Sound Art Radio are starting a new initiative called First Spark, and they're going to have a non-classical evening on Friday this week at 7:30 in the evening at the Barrel House in Totnes. And if you're not quite sure where that is, it's just at the top of the High Street in Totnes. And you can find the details on the Classical Journey website. We're going to have some wonderful music by Stockhausen, and also, if I can get to the details quickly, here we are. It comes just after the mention of Julie on the Classical Journey website. We've also got the music of Darius Milhaud, Le Bœuf sur le Toit, which featured on the Prelude of the Red Curtain on Sound Art Radio on Sunday this week. And most important of all, they're going to have a live performance of Giorgi Ligeti's poem symphonique pour son métronome. So we need 100 metronomes. So anyone with a wind-up metronome, do rush down to the Barrel House in Totnes on Friday, 31st of January, and the action will actually kick off at 8 p.m. Admission is £8, but if you bring your metronome, it's just £5 to attend. So that's my little mini rundown.
I'm very intrigued by that. So metronomes are the things that keep time, aren't they?
Keep the time of the music, a mechanical conductor. Yeah. But they do have to be the ones that wind up, because what's going to happen is that 100, we hope 100, will all be set off at different speeds, and they'll run down, the mechanism will run out at different times. So we get a very interesting effect, and you have to be there to experience
it. I'm very intrigued.
So anyone with a metronome, do rush down for that. I'll leave it to Jill to finish off the programme today. Do look out on the Classical Journey website for a link to Julie Sampson. She'll be on the programme next week. And do send any messages to luke@phonic.fm, luch@phonic.fm, or go to her website and use Twitter to speak to her directly. Jill.
Lovely. Well, the other book that I was going to talk a little bit about today is The Perfume Collector by Kathleen Tesoro, whichever. I'm about halfway through it, and I'm loving it. It's set in the 1950s, and again, as many books do, it has sort of flashbacks to the 1920s. And it's about a woman. She's quite young, but she's married, and things aren't going so well in her marriage. And one day, out of the blue, she gets a letter. I can quote. "Our firm is handling the estate of the deceased Mrs. Eva Dorsey, and it is our duty to inform you that you are named as the chief beneficiary in her will. We request your presence at our offices at your earliest convenience, so that we may go through the details of your inheritance."
And the inheritance is a...
Well, it's not so much the inheritance as the fact that she has no idea who this woman is. She's never heard of this woman, and suddenly she's been bequested this...
The care of.
Yes, yes. And so she's... it's a property in Paris, and some stocks and shares and things, and she's just completely bewildered. So she travels to Paris to find out who this woman was, and to visit the flat she is...
Oh, and we should stress, of course, that anyone receiving emails telling them that they've inherited property, do look at them very carefully. They're probably a scam.
Yes.
But in this case, it's real.
In this case,
in as much as it is a novel, but yeah, it's a very sort of surreal thing, as you can imagine. So this woman travels off to Paris, and I don't know what happens to her because I'm only, you know, just about halfway through the book. But there is obviously a mystery at its heart. We've got the two perspectives. We're kind of following Ava's journey in the early part of the book, the flashback sequences. So when she's a young woman in the 20s, because she obviously dies relatively young. She dies in the 50s, and I think one would imagine that she's probably in her 40s or 50s when she dies. So she's not old. And then also following Grace, who's inherited. And I've got my... because there must be some kind of connection. So I've got my guess as to what it might be, but I have no idea whether I'm right yet. We will see. The book's called The Perfume Collector, and we're just getting to details about perfumes and things now. The character Grace in the 1950s has kind of followed a trail of clues and has come to an abandoned perfume shop in Paris. And meanwhile, the young Ava in the 1920s has... she works at a hotel, and one of the guests is a perfumery. I don't know quite what the word is.
Perfumier.
That's the one. Yeah. So there's kind of the connections are being made, but we still don't know quite where they're going to lead. So, but it's really nicely written, and it's a really interesting read, like seeing where these connections are going, and it's, you know, understandably very sensual. So I suggest, listeners, that you pick it up and read it, and I will pick up the discussion of it next month on the show.
It's 25th of February.
Yep.
You'll be here at 10 o'clock, yes. Or maybe a little after.
Hopefully I will be more punctual next month. I'll set my alarm next time and not be fooled into thinking that the 5-year-old who always wakes me before 7 will...
And in the meantime, don't forget that on Wednesday next week, we have the opening of Osage, now August, Osage County. That's the Exeter University Theatre Company. And, of course, on Thursday this week, Thursday evening, in the Black Box here at the Phoenix, we have Julie Sampson, and she'll be talking about her book. That blog she was talking about is called Scrap Blog: A Writer from the Southwest. So if you can find that, you can read all about her. Thanks very much, Jill.
Thank you. And we've just got a little bit of Joan Byers. This is her singing Please Come to Boston.
And Classical Journey again next week. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Please come to Boston in the springtime. I'm staying here with some friends and they've got lots of room. You can sell your paintings out on the sidewalk at a cafe. I said no. Won't you come home to me? I said, a rambling boy, why don't you settle down? Boston ain't your kind of town. There ain't no gold and there ain't nobody like me. I'm the number one fan of the man from Tennessee. The snowfall, we'll move up into the mountains so far we can't be found. I'll shout I love you echoes into the canyon, and then lie awake at night till they come back around. Please come to the number one fan of shifter's world goes around and round. I doubt if it's ever gonna stop. But of all the dreams I've lost and found, and all that I ain't got, I still need to cling to, somebody I can sing to. Looks out over the ocean, and some stars that fell from the sky are living upon the hill. Please come to LA, but I said no. Won't you come home to me? I said, around and boy, why don't you settle down? Number one fan of